but still very different ways of thinking about how you run the corporation and what the purpose is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Again, one of the things that you mentioned in your book is that companies are net destroyers of investment capital because they spend more on stock buybacks than they raise in equity. So just explain that and describe how we should respond to it.
Yeah,
it's kind of funny.
I'll say two things. One is that specifically, I think the fact that companies that offer their equity to be traded on the open financial markets, on the public stock markets, they are repurchasing more of their own equity than they're issuing. Again, it's like we're so confused about what happens in the public stock markets that that's a really surprising fact to people. And I got really focused and learned from, you know, one of my mentors, Bill Lozanek, who I know you've had on a bunch, learned from him about stock buybacks and just became fascinated by the fact that they are this legal form of the manipulation of a company's stock price by the company. We don't allow that in so many other ways, but we allow it in this form, in the open market share repurchases that companies do, and we don't regulate it at all. So I've written and testified and done a lot of policymaking work in the last administration trying to get limits put on stock buybacks. But I think it's indicative of this broader confusion that we have about the open stock markets. And then the other thing I'll say is that, you know, actually a lot of my work right now is studying the private financial markets. So I, you know, lots of people have been studying and writing and organizing around private equity. I've become really interested in the private credit funds and their, you know, rapid growth and how pension funds and others are shifting more in that direction. And I think we have to, you know, also kind of remake our mental models for, you know, the second quarter of the 21st century in terms of how corporations are financed in general. There's going to be more and more non-financial corporations that are taking on debt and equity in the private financial markets. They don't have to disclose what's going on. It's really, you know, very opaque to most people. And it means that there's a lot of potential risk building up in that sector. So we don't know there how the kind of flows are necessarily moving in terms of, you know, net equity issuance. They're certainly moving very differently. But I think there's also the potential for a lot of risk and a lot of, you know, negative effects on innovation building up in the private financial markets as well.
What could go wrong? Right.
I mean, I try to not be a Cassandra, but I am a little bit. And I think the similarities that we see in private credit and their entanglement with non-financial corporations have a lot of similarities to 2007, 2008. Maybe that's for another episode, but it's scary.
Great.
Hey, Nick, it's capitalism. It's the best of all possible worlds. And if something goes wrong, it's because it's for the best. It's the invisible hand. It's just squeezing the inefficiencies out of the out of the economy. We should probably get to a more positive take on this. What are the things we can do to prevent things from going wrong? What might corporate governance look like after the shareholder primacy era?
Yeah, I think that there was actually some great kind of green shoots in the Biden administration around industrial policy in particular. And, you know, many of the people who worked in the Biden administration really recognized that we needed to push our corporations, you know, we needed to structure regulation and industrial policy so that corporations would focus on innovation and production and not financial extraction. So I think going back to that, you know, going towards an understanding of the corporation as the site of production and innovation for most activities in our economy, you know, leads us to a very different policy framework. I think we need a federal chartering system. This was something that Senator Elizabeth Warren proposed way back in 2018, the Accountable Capitalism Act, so that we can actually have the framework to regulate corporations at the federal level and not pretend anymore that they operate at the state level when we live in a multinational economy and not allow them to choose just their, you know, their site of incorporation when we don't allow them to choose where they operate, you know, what labor laws they operate under or what environmental laws they operate under. So one of the first kind of, you know, necessary but not sufficient proposals that's in my book is just a federal chartering system, which has a whole history in the U.S. that I won't go into here, but it's really interesting. And then I think we need to look at corporate boards. We need to think about who actually has a voice in the main decision-making practices of the corporation. There's lots of ways you can do this. There's models around the world that I think we can learn from but not adopt because we have a very unique setup in the U.S. in the intersection between our corporate and labor laws. But, you know, we can have worker voices on corporate boards. We can have boards be responsible for looking at the compensation across the company rather than focusing solely on C-suite compensation. We can have boards' fiduciary duties, their responsibilities, be towards the corporation itself rather than simply towards shareholders. So there's another whole range of policies, ways you could do this, but really change what the corporate board is responsible for. You can then limit different types of corporate extractive financial practices. I focused a lot on stock buybacks because they're just fascinating and totally unregulated, but tax policy comes in here. Lots of other ways in which we can, focus corporations on using their resources, their retained earnings, to invest in the innovative process. And there's, you know, other approaches that I think are necessary to make corporate governance, you know, effective. We also need, I think, a strengthening of the right to organize. We need, you know, we need environmental laws to be stronger. We need a whole other ecosystem around it. But I've tried to focus on corporate governance really, honestly, in part because it's something that I thought progressives weren't paying enough attention to. So before I was, you know, in academia, I was a union organizer. I worked at Move On for a long time. I was a political organizer. I was an economist at the Roosevelt Institute. And so I've seen the conversations that we've been having for, you know, lots and lots of years around what a progressive economic vision looks like. And I have felt for a long time like corporate governance, how corporations actually work and are regulated, wasn't enough part of that conversation. And so that's why in this book, what I'm trying to do is not necessarily put forward, you know, the end all be all set of solutions, but say we actually have the power, we can regulate corporate governance in a different way. Shareholder primacy is not, you know, didn't come down on stone tablets from Moses. It's not the only way. And so hopefully the book provides a little bit of a opening of the aperture in terms of how we think about corporate governance.
Ideas on how to change norms? Because in fact, when Friedman published, was it 1970? In the New York Times, he was widely ridiculed. It was a very fringe idea that was not the norm in American business back then,
right.
And now it is. And to suggest otherwise is ridiculed. How do we reset our norms on this?
It's fascinating too because people don't realize that you wrote that article in response to Ralph Nader's campaign GM. So it was a moment when there was a civil society movement towards recognizing, I think, some of the harms of corporations. And this was a response, a sort of way to say, no, we can't actually have the corporation have any set of social responsibilities. Although some people argue that he actually had a much narrower vision of what he meant than how it's been interpreted over the last 50 years or 55 years, I guess. I think that, you know, norms shift through, you know, over the long term through people understanding the harms that shareholder primacy has been created. That's, you know, really what motivates me through, you know, people becoming more educated about how the system is set up and how it impacts the larger issues we care about, like economic inequality, climate change. And it'll take, you know, some brave political leaders to make this an area where they want to plant a flag. We've seen, you know, certainly different politicians over the last 5 or 6 years really focus on this, along with focusing on market power during the Biden administration. And I think that has an important effect of making people wake up and sort of see what the impacts of shareholder primacy have been.
So final question, why do you do this work?
And why I do this work in particular is because, as I said, I was a union organizer, I was a labor organizer, I come from a union family. You know, for a long time in working on corporate power issues, in fighting so hard for dignity and respect at the workplace, you have to ask, like, where is the money going? And that was, for me, just always the motivating question. Where is this money going and why? And so I became focused on shareholder primacy as a place where I felt that I could help bring some more light to the system and hopefully give tools and resources to people who are doing workplace organizing and doing organizing to improve the economy, give them some more tools and frameworks to understand and hopefully change this larger system.
Awesome.
Great.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Lenore.
Definitely. Thanks so much for having me.
So a couple takeaways, Nick. One is, and this is something we repeat a lot, which people lose sight of, is that economics is a choice.
Yeah.
That corporations aren't structured this way, governed this way, because that's the only way to do it. It's a choice we've made both legally, morally, politically, socially, that it's okay and, in fact, preferable for corporations to just focus on maximizing shareholder value, the public good be damned. It is a choice, Nick, to actually believe that managing corporations this way will, you know, transubstantiate investor selfishness into the public good. It's we choose to believe that because it's convenient for the people who own the shares.
Yep. No.
My other takeaway, and that is we brought up the idea of risk, that the reason why the owners of shares should be rewarded is because they're taking the risk that if the company goes bankrupt, they're the last ones who get paid off. They lose everything. And I mean, any person who's worked in the real world knows that that's not true. And I'm going to use my daughter as an example. She's 28 years old. She's in the industry of her choice. And, you know, she was applying for jobs recently, and she had to make this decision which one to take. Which, you know, should she take the job that takes her out of the city, that she has to move someplace and take that risk, which is, you know, potentially a better job, but is isolated more from the rest of the industry. So if it doesn't go well, she's got fewer choices, but move back. Does she take the job on at this company, which seems like the better job, but it pays less, and she knows it's more short term because the project she's would be working on is coming to an end? Or should she hold off and take neither of those jobs and wait for something else, which probably is coming along in another month, but might not happen. She doesn't know. And people are making these choices all the time. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, wages tend to stagnate. And, you know, because it's risky to switch jobs.
Yeah.
And people make, you know, decisions all the time based on what they're promised by the new employer. And then a few months in, that's reneged upon. And because almost everybody, you know, very few people have a contract, they're just at will employees, they can change the terms on you. They
can
cut your wages.
And again, it's so easy to sell stock in a public company. It's so hard to quit a job and find a new one. Right? The difference is so profound. And by the way, customers take risk too, right? Like when you buy a product from a company, you know, like you assume that you will get what you paid for. You assume that it won't harm, it won't create harm. You know, like there's all sorts of risks in any supply chain. And it's just not true that the only people who take real risk are shareholders. And I think in many ways, the shareholders in public companies are the ones taking the least risk because they're in the position that's the most liquid, right?
Right.
You can change your mind at any moment. Like you can just wake up in the morning and sell your whole position and you're out. But, you know, customers can't do that and employees can't do that.
Right.
Right?
You buy
it's just hard.
You buy a GE fridge and, you know, one day out of warranty, the thing, the compressor breaks. You're shit out of luck.
Well, interesting subject.
Yep. And again, you know, you might not think there is such a thing as a good company, but we will provide a link in the show notes to Lenore's book, Good Company, Economic Policy After Shareholder Primacy.
Pitchfork Economics is produced by Civic Ventures. If you like the show, make sure to follow, rate, and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Find us on other platforms like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Pitchfork Economics. Nick's on Twitter and Facebook as well, at Nick Hanauer. For more content from us, you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter, The Pitch, over on Substack. And for links to everything we just mentioned, plus transcripts and more, visit our website, pitchforkeconomics.com. As always, from our team at Civic Ventures, thanks for listening. See you next week.
Quiet, please. Quiet, please. The Mutual Broadcasting System presents Quiet, Please, which is written and directed by Willis Cooper and which features Ernest Chappell. Quiet, Please for tonight is called The Room Where the Ghosts Live.
No. No, I won't let you take me out of the house. No, I'm going to stay right here. I'm sorry, Doctor.
But, Lawrence, we've got to get you to a hospital. Now stop being a fool.
I won't. I'm going to die anyway, and I don't want to die in an ambulance somewhere out on an icy road between here and town. I'm sorry, that's final.
I can't do anything for you here, Lawrence.
Maybe I don't want you to do anything for me, Doctor.
I'm going to call the ambulance.
How?
By telephone, of course.
The telephone isn't working.
Oh, that's right, I forgot.
That's funny, isn't it?
What?
What a couple of days of snow can do. No lights, no heat, no water. Just like the days when they lived here.
When who lived here?
The ghosts.
Open your mouth.
What for?
Thermometer.
I'm not raving, Doctor.
Well, let's see anyway. Feel any pain?
Sure.
Worse than it was?
A little
morphia won't hurt. It's a good thing I decided to stop in for a cup of coffee. You might have died here all by yourself.
I'm going to die anyway.
Not if I can help it.
Can't help.
Oh, stop that nonsense. May I have your ball? All right, now. That'll relieve the pain in a minute or two.
Okay.
I could take you to the hospital in my car.
No.
And I think I will.
No.
Lawrence, what got into you? What do you want to die for?
Take some hours.
No, not yet. There's nothing wrong with you. You've been the happiest. You've got everything to live for.
No.
Then you go and shoot yourself.
Yep.
Where did you get this pistol, anyway?
Gift.
Didn't you know it was loaded?
Sure.
That powder and ball have probably been in there for 50 years.
Longer than that.
What?
Longer than that.
Well, there's no telling what kind of infection you can get from that bullet.
No. Don't die at all.
Let's see that thermometer.
High temperature, huh?
Yeah, it's just pretty high. I guess you're not going to the hospital after all, though.
I told you that, Doctor.
I couldn't move you with that high temperature.
That's fine. But I told you I wasn't going to be moved anyway. So you see...
Who gave you this pistol?
A British colonel.
What British colonel?
His name's on the lock plate.
Lieutenant Colonel Robert Charles Graves, 17th Regiment of Foot, 1774. Ancestor of the fellow that gave it to you?
No. He gave it to me himself yesterday.
Lawrence, how could he?
He's one of the ghosts.
I see.
No, you don't. I'm not delirious, Doctor. He really is.
No, no. Just relax, Lawrence.
Of course. I'm going to die anyway. Isn't that so?
I'm afraid it is.
Good.
Lawrence.
What?
Why did you do it?
Well, I'm not sure whether I did it on purpose or not. I wanted to, but maybe it was an accident. Or maybe
what?
Maybe one of the ghosts. No, I don't think so. I guess it was an accident. I'm glad, though.
But why?
Well, on account of Melanie.
Melanie? Melanie who? Who's Melanie?
Melanie is a girl who lived here 170 years ago.
What?
And who still lives here. It hurts quite a bit, Doctor.
You want me to give you some more morphine?
I guess not. No. I want to tell you things.
Well...
You won't believe me, of course. You think my mind's wandering. Don't you?
Well, I... What difference does it make?
Yeah, that's right. Nothing makes any difference, no. The fellow takes a long time dying, doesn't he? After a while, we had the time, huh? Pretty soon, I'll be a ghost to see Melanie. I'd like a little drink of brandy.
Well, just a second. Here, now take it easy.
Thanks. Good brandy. Wish I could take some along. It's good.
I wish I could do something for you, Lawrence.
Nothing snowed in, aren't we? Sure. I mustn't leave. I couldn't come back, you know. I have to stay here.
I don't understand that.
I have to stay here, I said. My house. What was I talking about?
The ghosts.
Oh, yes. So I tried to keep the house like it was in the old days, see, all by myself. Been fun. And then noises. Heard noises.
What kind of noises?
People beating on door, rattling the latch. Every night. I'm not afraid, Doctor.
I know, Lawrence.
Well, I got up, went all over the house. Noises stopped after a while.
It wasn't a dream?
No dream. Beating on a door someplace. Always sounded like it came from right over there. You see?
Well, there isn't any door there, Lawrence.
That's what I thought. My hands are cold.
I'll build up the fire.
No. I know what it is. I haven't got much time, huh? Have I?
No, Lawrence, you haven't got much time, old man.
I'll have to hurry. Shut your eyes so you can see what I saw. I mean, I didn't see it, see, because it was dark. So, when you shut your eyes, you feel the way I felt.
All right, Lawrence.
I walked all over the house, lights on. No sound, no hammering on door. No door. I turn off the lights, it starts again. From right over there. I turn on the lights. No door. No noise. And then I get an idea. I turn off the lights again. I walk over where the sound comes from. And there is a door. And I think I hear a woman crying. And footsteps and furniture being shoved around. I said I wasn't scared, didn't I? Well, I was then. You'd be scared too, finding a door where there isn't any door and there's somebody on the other side.
But that's the outside wall of the house, Lawrence.
No.
What?
There's a room there. The room where the ghosts lived. You see?
No, I don't.
I didn't know it, too. You got your eyes shut?
Yes.
If you could hear the noise like I heard it. Frantic pounding. People pushing their shoulders against the locked door. And I could smell smoke. You see, I didn't know about the ghosts then.
Well, how do you know now?
I'm trying to tell you.
I'm sorry.
Keep your eyes shut. I want you to feel the way I felt. Believe. I reach for the lights again. I turn them on. Nothing happens, just nothing. Except pounding on the door. Slower now. And the woman crying. And I hear her scream. Au secours, she said. It's French. It means help, help. I heard her voice again, frightened.
Ouvrez
la porte, she said. That's French, too, means open the door. So I tried to open it, and it was locked. And they were pounding. She was coughing. And at last I found the key. I yanked the door open, and the ghosts came out. The lights came back on. There wasn't any door. There wasn't anybody in the room but me. But then I heard something. Somebody walking across the floor down the hall. So I turned and went down the hall after the footsteps, down toward my room. Then I stopped dead. Because the door to my room closed and somebody locked it.
You dreamed that?
No. It was locked from the inside. So was every other door in the house.
That couldn't be.
Try the doors. Open your eyes and try the doors. Go ahead.
Lawrence, I...
No, go ahead. I'll keep on talking. You have to believe me. Go ahead. So, what did I do? I lay down here on the Davenport with the lights on. I tried to think, but nothing made any sense. I got up and I tried the outside door. It was unlocked. So I went outside. I had some crazy idea. Maybe there was a room there. There wasn't, of course. But there were footprints in the snow. Some men's footprints. And a girl's. This last nose covered them all up again, I guess. Well, what about the doors, Doctor?
They're locked. On the inside.
You see? Did you hear anything? Did you?
Well, I thought I heard someone moving. As if I'd awakened somebody. But it was probably my imagination.
No, it wasn't.
No, Mandy.
So I came back in and I sat down. And I hardly noticed that the lights were off again. Then I heard something else. And I said, "Who's that?" And a woman's voice answered me in the dark.
"I'm Melanie."
"Well, who's Melanie?"
"Once I was a maid in this house in the time of the war, when the soldiers were captured on Christmas night at Trenton. And these escaped and came here to be hidden by Monsieur Maurice. For he was not a patriot, and they were kept
there. You'd think I'd be surprised, but I wasn't very. I didn't interrupt her. She went right on telling me how Morris was a loyalist, and how he hid the officers, and how the neighbors suspected him and spied on him.
Then Monsieur Maurice must go away, you see. And I was left alone to bring food to the poor soldiers. And there was a night when I took their food to them. And when I would go from the room, I found the door to be locked from the other side. But soon we smelled the smoke of the fire. For someone had set fire to the house to destroy these men. And we beat upon the door. But it did not avail us. And so we perished in the fire. I and the British officers. And there was none to know our fate. And for our sins, we are bound forever to this house. Although I have not sinned so very greatly. And I would thank you for releasing us from that room. For so many times we have cried out, yet no one would open the door."
"And I opened the door, but now all my doors are locked against me."
"Yes. They say it is their house now. And no man can open the doors again."
"I think we'll see about that."
"They say you must go away."
"Well, I'm not going away."
"I should be sorry when you go away."
"You would?"
"You have released us. I am grateful."
"Thanks. I think they'd be grateful, too."
"They are soldiers, monsieur. And they have not forgotten the manner of their death. This is their revenge, that no man shall live in this house."
"Well, that's fine. I'm to be chased out of my house by a bunch of ghosts."
"It is so, monsieur."
"How do you feel about it?"
I could wish you could always be here, monsieur."
"So?"
"Yes, monsieur. But it cannot be. Unless
what?"
"It cannot be."
"If I turned on the lights, could I see you?"
"No, monsieur. The eyes of the living cannot see us."
"What did you look like?"
I did have blue eyes, monsieur. And my hair was black. And I was not very tall. And my feet were very small."
"And your clothes?"
"Once I had a gown of taffeta, and it was blue, like my eyes, I remember. And there was a cap of lace for my grandmère in Brittany."
And I was struck with a sudden impulse to see this girl with the black hair and the taffeta dress that matched her eyes. And I jumped up and snapped the lights on. And the room was empty. And so I knew I'd been dreaming."
"Of course."
"But I wasn't dreaming, my friend. She came to me the next night. And the next. Oh, it's so cold. Am I dying now? Is this what it feels like?"
"Here, take a little sip of this."
"Oh.
Better?"
"How much longer? Well, see, friend, I found myself in love with a ghost." "Yes, Melanie. And she loves me, Doctor. And we talked about it so much. There must be a way out. But there couldn't be a way out. And the others kept telling her I must go on, and I asked you to go to them. sorry. Go to them and beg them to let me stay. It was the only way. But she told me, they said, no, they made a pact between themselves and they'd not alter it. And the time was getting short. They were sorry, they said, but... And then, last night, she came to me again. When the snow was piling deeper and deeper around the windows, and I said, Melanie, I can't go now. Can't they see that? And she said...
I have spoken again with the colonel.
And what did he say?
He will come to you, he said.
And what?
He will not speak to the living.
But what good?
I do not know. He said he will come to you.
When?
Tonight. Do not speak. Say, Monsieur le Colonel. I have the honor to present Monsieur the Lieutenant Colonel Robert Charles Graves of His Majesty's 17th Regiment of Foot. Monsieur the Colonel wishes me to present his compliments to you and to say to you that he has taken counsel with his fellow officers. No, do not speak. Monsieur le Colonel wishes me also to say that he and his fellow officers have come to a decision in the matter of yourself. They honor you for your devotion to me. And they beg leave to supply you with the means of assuring you permanent residence in this house. Monsieur the Colonel begs you to accept as a token of his esteem.
I turned on the lights. It was there on the floor. Flintlock pistol loaded Gaudetia Black Flint. Personal gift from Robert Charles Graves, 17th Foot. Well, I thought a long time. Turned off the lights. Called her. No answer. Talked to her. Told her I loved her. Wasn't brave enough to... Said I loved her. Couldn't do it. Tried. No, I didn't do it. No, I didn't. Long toward morning, heard footsteps again. Boots, sword, spurs clicking. Knew who it was. Said, hello, Colonel. Said, Colonel, thanks, only haven't got courage enough. Oh, his lover, Colonel, I said. Said, here's your pistol. I'm a coward. Drink, please. Well, I wake up here. Daylight. See? If Colonel Graves could enough fellas show me way out, couldn't that fella pull trigger for me? Hello. Melanie, in your blue taffety dress, and your blue eyes, and your black.
You have
Listen to Quiet, Please, which is written and directed by Willis Cooper. Lawrence, the man who spoke to you, was Ernest Chappell. And Melanie was Claudia Morgan. The doctor was played by James Van Dyke. Our sound effects by Albert April. Music for Quiet, Please, except for our theme, which is from the Allegretto movement of the César Franck Symphony in D minor, is composed and played by Albert Berman. Now for a word about next week's Quiet, Please, here is our writer-director, Willis Cooper.
Baker's Dozen is the title of next week's story, the story of one man, two men.
It's Music Till Dawn. Music Till Dawn is 6 hours of everything that's great in modern radio entertainment. You'll hear news as it happens, sports scores, and information about what's going on in Toronto. There'll be lots of laughs, but mostly music. It's all brought to you by Craven A Cigarettes. So from now right up till 6 a.m., it's Music Till Dawn.
Time.